Hello and welcome to Radio Reading Services and the Smithsonian Magazine for July and August 2019. I am your host, Gail Fisher. We are bringing to you the end of a very long article on Herman Melville. It is written by a gentleman by the name of William T. Boltman. The article is entitled Melville's Last Paradise, and our author describes it as his improbable voyage in search of the misunderstood author of America's greatest epic adventure. You'll recall he has divided this into chapters, and we are now at chapter 16. After writing epic parable of a man who relentlessly pursues the mystery that destroys him, Melville turned, as they say, inward, or at least landward. He must have been coming apart by then, whenever the blasts of poverty, humiliation, hatred, derision, and disappointment pierced him. He came apart more dramatically, the way a sailing ship might unravel in a typhoon, its rigging all a squiggle, like a cat's hair standing on the end. What he had written concerning Ahab now became applicable to himself. God help thee, old man, thy thoughts have created a creature in thee, and he whose intense thinking thus makes him a Prometheus, a vulture feeds upon that heart forever. That vulture, the very creature he creates. Chapter 17. His American publisher, the Harpers, who had already forced him into ruinous financial terms, disavowed his next work, Pierre. Alas, a novel about a desperate writer coming undone. His kindly British publisher offered to bring it out, but not soon, and without any advance. Distraught, Melville never answered. Thus ended his independent publication on the other side of the Atlantic. That was in 1852. In May 1853, he completed The Isle of the Cross. The Harpers rejected that book, which was subsequently lost. He might have burned it. But because his past book failures had left him in debt to them, they permitted him to write anonymously for their magazine. He also wrote for the periodical Putnam's over the next year. For them, he produced his greatest short stories, Bartleby the Scrivener, whose, quote, I would prefer not to haunt us to this day, and the brooding ironic Benito Cereno, in which an apparent reality gets turned inside out. In both tales, we find the inverse of those youthful, good-hearted generalizations about otherness that stud the pages of the South Sea novels. Meanwhile, their author got rheumatism and defaulted on his debts. Although Melville lived 40 years after Moby Dick, they were hardly good years. Let me therefore heed the dictum put forth near the end of Israel Potter, his 1855 novel of the eponymous Yankee rebel imprisoned in Britain. Best followed now is This Life by Hurrying, like itself, to a close. Few things remain. Having lost Arrowhead, their home, as a result of his debts, the family removed to New York. In 1857, The Confidence Man was published. It earned him not a penny. His various poems did no better, even his impeccably patriotic ones. About the time the Civil War started, his generous father-in-law died. The legacy to Lizzie allowed her to provide for the family for a little while. In 1866, her husband finally got a job, drudging as a customs inspector in New York for $1,000, $4 per day. He kept at it for almost 20 years. Chapter 18. By 1867, writes Herschel Parker, the Shaws were saying Lizzie believed that Herman was insane. She seems to have considered separating from him. That same year, their son Malcolm accidentally, or deliberately shot himself in bed, dead at 18. 9 years later, when Lizzie was helping him read the proofs for his vanity-published poem, Clairol, which the New York Independent pronounced destitute of interest or metrical skill, she wrote in a letter that he was in a frighteningly nervous state. In 1886, he finally retired from the Custom House. 5 years later, with Billy Budd, another masterpiece unfinished, he died, appropriately enough, of an enlarged heart. After running a belated obituary, the New York Times published a pleasant enough memorial, the late Hiram Melville. Fashions change. Now we praise Melville for his dark, beautiful obscurities, the oceanic swells of alterations from story to essay to joke and back again. In Why Read Moby Dick?, an extravagant little volume from 2011, Nathaniel Philbrick interpreted that masterwork as a cosmic repository for our national destiny. Quoting, "Contained in the pages of Moby Dick is nothing less than the genetic code of America. All the promises, problems, conflicts, and ideals that contributed to the outbreak of a revolution in 1775, as well as a civil war in 1861, and continue to drive this country's ever-contentious march into the future." End quote. I praise Melville because, in at least one way, he was an ideal American. He celebrated the equality of all our brothers and sisters. How many other Americans of his era could have written so tolerantly, even lovingly, of the tattooed cannibal harpooner Queequeg? And what is it that, I thought I, after all, it's only his outside. A man can be honest in any sort of skin. Whether or not Queequeg ever existed, or Faraway was Peyu, Melville brought Polynesia back within him and showed his great-heartedness by honoring it. And finally, Chapter 19. "And now, ever after, as I reread Typee, I will remember the emerald green jungle. Omu is all ocean and islands, blue and green. Moby Dick encompasses the two poles of colorlessness, deep undersea darkness, the ultimate destination of the Pequod, and all of us, which is to say the home of the white whale." But no, while I call Typee an emerald book, anyone who craves the dark depths of Moby Dick need only descend the wriggling road below those smoothed-out saw blades of the Typee Valley, with the night clouds still faintly luminescent, the valley black with ferns and leaves leaping at the eye at each switchback, the abyss itself a reified negation. Here comes another banana tree, a golden spider in the headlights. The dark mountains go higher and higher up the windshield. The road stays pallidly ugly. Infrequently I glimpse white trunks of trees in the darkness. I smell hummus. By now we have descended so far that the sky is nearly out of sight. A little more than 500 feet from the trail to the Tua Melville, I discern nothing but darkness between the pale trees. Then we are there, with the plants like white skeletons, drowning in more darkness. From down there where Melville used to live, I smell moss and hear a dreary rustling. We turn to another author, or an article on another author, but this one is a little different. It is written by Jay Perini and entitled Geography of Genius: The Mysterious Beauty of the World That Inspired the Stark Lyricism of Robert Frost. For much of my adult life, I've lived in the country Robert Frost called north of Boston. There were 7 years in New Hampshire, now 36 in Vermont, and I feel pretty sure I'll end my days surrounded by small villages, isolated farms, stands of maple and spruce, snowy fields, dry stone walls, cold running brooks, and lots of reticent people whose conversation often doesn't run beyond yep or nope. To say I'm glad to live in this world is an understatement. This is home. It was reading Frost's Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening when I was 15 that set me on the path that led to my adult life. I eventually became his biographer. I'll never forget being stunned by these lines in that poem, which features a lonely man, a horse-drawn sled, and the dark and deep woods that surround him. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind in downy flake. I fell in love with that voice, so lyrical and centered, and begged my parents to take a vacation in Frost Country. And they generously agreed. We packed up the car in Pennsylvania and drove to New Hampshire and Vermont to have a look around. Needless to say, the landscape spoke to me, and it still does. In fact, it has become a conversation of sorts. I speak back to it as well, writing poems that reflect the world around me. For me, poetry is always language adequate to experience, and this seems especially true of Frost and the images he summons in his poems. Probably the best of his poetry moves through the seasons, which he takes to represent the seasons of the soul. We move from the hushed October morning mild of October to the almost terrifying silence of the winter fields, with lonely mailboxes and fences, with the odd truck on a country lane, or the intense beauty of leafless trees, their limbs black against the white sky, to the immense emptiness of a snowy day, when there are no tracks anywhere, just the blank slate waiting to be filled in whatever ways life that day will afford. The winter deepens inside and out, as Frost suggests in Desert Places. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. Spring, as Frost says, is the mischief in me as a mending wall, where he walks the line with his neighbor to repair the dry stone wall that separates their properties. And in the beautiful spring pools, which might well be Frost's finest poem, he talks about the mirrors of water from melted snow that reflect the sky, almost without defect. These pools chill and shiver in the woods as the oak and maple and beech and birch all soak up the liquid to bring dark foliage on. These symbolic pools have a power in them as they set in motion a process of transformation that leads at last to the glories of summer. And summer, for Frost, is a season when we experience the heat of the sun in meadows and uncut fields, a season of flowers by the roadside, a season of birdsong. Midsummer is to spring as 1 to 10, he says, in The Oven Bird, one of my favorite poems. It's the high point in life's cycle, and yet buried in its midst, one senses the end of summer. Quote, that other fall we name the fall, The Oven Bird, is a warbler that sings, like the poet, of the passing of all good things. The question that he frames in all but words is what to make of a diminished thing. End quote. My life mirrors Frost in so many ways. I live in a farmhouse that dates to 1850, a house where the hired hands from the nearby farm lived in the 19th century. Along the way, this became a family house. What's strange is that so little has changed here. The imagery of my life is the imagery of Frost's poetry. And, like Frost himself, who lived nearby, I like walking in the woods in every season. A clarity is found in the silence and the beauty of these woods when one drinks in the surroundings. Here are your waters and your watering place, he writes in the last line of directive, saying, drink and be whole again beyond confusion. And now to our final article in this double issue. It is entitled Snakelandia and written by Ian Fraser. Bounty hunters and biologists wade deep into the Everglades to wrestle with the invasion of giant pythons threatening Florida's wetlands. In the Everglades, everything still looks the same. The waving sawgrass, the cypress and the pine trees draped with air plants, the high white clouds parked like dirigibles above their shadows. If you've ever been to the Everglades before and you go back, you'll still find these. But now there is also a weird quiet. In the campsites of Everglades National Park, raccoons don't rattle the trash can lids at 4 in the morning. Marsh rabbits don't scatter with a nervous rustle on the hiking trails as you walk by. Tires don't shriek when somebody breaks to avoid an opossum transfixed by headlights in the middle of the road. In fact, roadkill, which used to be common in this wildest part of Florida, is no longer seen. The raccoons and marsh rabbits and opossums and other small warm-blooded animals are gone, or almost gone, because Burmese pythons seem to have eaten them. The marsh's weird outdoor quiet is the deep, endlessly patient, laser-focused quiet of these invasive predators. About 2 feet long when hatched, Burmese pythons can grow to 20 feet and 200 pounds. They are among the largest snakes in the world. The pythons are mostly ambush hunters and constrictors. They kill small animals by biting them on or near the head and suffocating them as they are swallowed. Larger animals are seized whenever it is convenient and crushed and strangled in the coils before and during swallowing. Large constrictor snakes have not existed in North America for millions of years. Native wildlife species have never seen them before and may not recognize them as predators. In Miami, a center of the exotic pet trade, dealers used to import them from Southeast Asia by the tens of thousands. It is now illegal to import or purchase Burmese pythons in Florida. Probably at some point, python owners who no longer wanted to care for them let them go into the Everglades. By the mid-1990s, the pythons had established a breeding population. For 25 years, they have been eating any animals they can get their mouths around. Given the extremely stretchy cartilage joint connecting their jaws to their heads, and their ability to extend their windpipe, snorkel-like, outside their mouths so they can breathe while their mouths are being entirely occupied with swallowing. That's a lot of animals. A 2013 study found that of a group of marsh rabbits fitted with radio transmitters and released into python territory, 77% of those that died within a year had been eaten by pythons. Scientists say that the snakes are responsible for a recent 90 to 99% drop in the small mammal population in the national park. No one knows how many pythons are out there now. Estimates run from 10,000 to perhaps hundreds of thousands. A problem with trying to count them is that they are what scientists call cryptic, hard to detect. Their black, brown, tan camouflage fits perfectly in the marsh, as well as in the higher sandy ground that makes up another part of their range. They are good swimmers and can stay underwater for half an hour or more. Frank Mazzotti, a scientist who has been studying them for more than a decade, told me about a time when he and his colleagues caught a python, attached a radio transmitter for research purposes, and released it. I was holding the back end of the snake, and the front end was in some shallow water, Mazzotti said. I looked and looked, but I could not see the front end of the snake that I was holding on to. That's when I understood that these snakes were amazing, and we were in trouble. The Everglades, a vast subtropical wetland, is unlike any other place on Earth. It is essentially a wide, shallow, extremely slow-moving river, sometimes called a river of grass, that flows from Lake Okeechobee across the southern quarter of the state. North to south, it covers more than 100 miles. Florida's porous limestone bedrock provides its floor, and the plants that grew and decayed over a millennia have laid down layers of peat on top of that. Stretching for more than 50 miles east to west, the Everglades include sawgrass prairie, pine tree-covered ground, small limestone islands, cypress swamps, and mangrove forest along the ocean. If the Florida Peninsula is a thumb, the Everglades are the thumbnail, and the metro areas of Miami in the east and Naples in the west are the cuticles. Millions of people live in the metro areas right up to the edges of the Everglades, where, by comparison, there's hardly anyone. Seminole Miccosukee Indians, whom the U.S. Army failed to dislodge in the 19th century, occupy several reservations in and around the Everglades. Almost nobody else seems to have figured out how to live in the area without damaging it. When feathers were a fashion rage 100 years ago, and more hunters killed a huge number of the region's birds, then developers trained millions of acres for agriculture and caused all kinds of problems with runoff fires and, in annual dry seasons, dust storms. Sugar cane and other farming led to phosphate pollution, which changed the region's flora. In the 1970s, it became obvious that environmental degradation of the Everglades threatened South Florida's water supply. It might eventually make the metro areas unlivable. State and federal agencies enacted large-scale measures, still in progress, to try to improve the situation. Burmese pythons are simply the latest in a series of environmental nightmares we've inflicted on the Everglades. Snakes in general tend to freak people out. Scientists who work with snakes get tired of people who say how much they hate them. But snakes aren't crazy about people either. A python's typical reaction to a human being is to hide or try to get away. As I thought about and observed pythons, I remembered a definition I read somewhere. Man is a creature of meaningful intentions. That is true of other living things, especially pythons. They are meaningful intention made flesh, going about their business, doing what they evolved to do. That they happen to fall into an environment ideally suited to them is our fault, not theirs. All the same, they really should not be here. We Americans can't agree on much, but most Floridians agree that having large invasive snakes eating up the native wildlife is not a good thing. Given the python's many survival advantages, they will never be eliminated. Today, the objective is containment and control. Ian Bartosik, a compact, muscular, dark-haired 42-year-old wildlife biologist, lives in Naples and works for the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Bartosik has single-handedly caught Burmese pythons that are 2 and 3 times as long as he is tall. At the Naples Botanical Gardens, where he was once called to remove a 9-foot-long python basking on a lawn, the staff refers to him as, quote, "the guy who caught the snake with his feet," end quote. When he arrived at the scene, the snake had disappeared into a pond. Bartosik removed his shoes and socks, waded into the pond, felt around with his feet, located the snake, reached under the surface, grabbed it behind the head, and brought it out. The Conservancy of South Florida is a nonprofit scientific organization that has received funding from the U.S. Geological Survey, the Naples Zoo Conservation Fund, and private donors. It works to preserve the original local landscape along with the native wildlife and plants. By doing this, it hopes also to strengthen the area's resilience in the new extreme weather of climate change. Bartosik and the rest of his python team, Ian Esterling, age 27, and Katie King, age 23, who both have backgrounds in snake biology, study and remove pythons in order to advance science and stay ahead of the invasion. One morning in early February, the three of them led me into the swamps of Greater Naples. For orientation, they first showed me the satellite images of the region on a computer screen. Urban and suburban development here. Corporate vegetable farms there. And wild Everglades country extending southward and eastward almost everywhere else. All of it cupped by the dark blue semicircle of the ocean. Since 2013, the Conservancy has been tracking what it calls sentinel snakes. These are male Burmese pythons in whom radio transmitters have been surgically implanted, and placing transmitters outside the body have proved impractical with snakes. The team tracks 23 of these pythons, each signaling at its own radio frequency. Dots on the satellite map indicated where each snake had been heard from last. We'll find out more about snakes, which actually I like, if I may say so. And on behalf of Radio Reading Services, we'll return next week to continue this article. On behalf of Radio Reading, thank you so much for listening and welcoming us into your homes today. We wish you a great day and a wonderful week ahead.